You are now listening to WBPPR, Big Pretty Public Radio. The following program has been brought to you by no one, apparently, because despite the numerous emails, text messages, and phone calls, my producer Natalie has refused to provide me with the needed information. How long can a show like this last without sponsors? That is a question for which I do not have an answer. And now, an evening with the authors. I am your host for now, Dana Glass. Loyal listeners, I sit here in studio, a studio to which my key card no longer works. Luckily, our maintenance man Gustavo was kind enough to let me into the building, and although he explained this would be the only time he would put his job on the line for me, I am happy that he did so help me to be here to do the one thing in my life I can be proud of. Intern Marley has been so kind to join me and work the switchboard once again. I don't know what is going on, but I do not like it. I feel betrayed, I feel victimized, and I feel, most of all, nothing. An empty void in my soul, in my mind, in the universe, pulling me toward it, ready to devour me whole and consume this worthless shell that I have become. We have a very full show, and I think it's time to jump right in. The game of Dungeons and Dragons is intended to bring friends together as they go on fantastical journeys and forge greater connections. However, sometimes it can shatter lifelong bonds and even destroy families. We will now hear, reading from his book, The Friendship Gauntlet, How I Destroyed a Bunch of Nerds' Lives, is Zach Chadworth.
Read from my book, Friendship Gauntlet. Let's just fucking go. Chapter 1, The Incident. It was August of 2017. I just walked out of the happy hour at Champ Sports Bar. It's pretty hot. ESPN had just confirmed that Andrew Luck wouldn't be playing for the entire 2017 season. Also, I'd gotten a text from my second wife, Tracy, informing me that she was leaving me for her personal trainer, Garrett. Yeah, let's fucking see Garrett soul cycle her to Aruba twice a year. Not gonna fucking happen. Mostly it was news about Andrew. Fuck, that sucked. That sucked. Almost as soon as I stepped outside, about 8 of those super geeks from the thing at the convention center bumped into me. They all said they were sorry, and one of them playfully tapped me on the shoulder with a foam sword. Excuse me. Hang on. Hello? Yeah, no. They all said they're sorry. One of them playfully tapped me on the shoulder with a foam sword. I don't know what happened, but according to the police report, I punched 3 of them, and apparently I threw a hobbit. Told my lawyer it was all bullshit, but the security footage pretty much said the same thing as the police report did. To be fair, the guy was tiny, like pretty tiny, like as normal short as you can be. If I'm being honest, I was coming in pretty hot on scotch and water, so I was acting on instinct at that point. The judge was one of these new wave liberals with an art degree who gives out cute sentences that, quite honestly, I'm pretty sure are unconstitutional. But if it kept me from having to knife fight half of MS-13, I'll play your game. He felt that I needed to better understand my victims. I was ordered to respond to a Craigslist ad looking for a dungeon master and run a game of Dungeons and Dragons for 5 nerds for a year. This was a terrible idea. It's good. Chapter 2 is titled Game 1. We were wrapping up the final battle when Carl, the party's wizard, had finally grown some balls and cast his fireball spell on the last horde of orcs. Most of the orcs had passed their dexterity saving throws, but the geeks didn't know that, and I was tired and decided to wipe out the orc horde anyway. This is probably my favorite part of Dungeons & Dragons, is being a dungeon master, you're allowed to lie whenever you want, and no one can do shit about it. After the game, Carl pulled me aside, which I said, don't ever touch my arm again. And what do you want? The multiple waves of orcs made the fight seem unfair, Carl replied. I was nearly out of spells, and I don't see what they had to do with the story. My blood pressure rose so goddamn fast I went deaf for a few seconds. Said Carl, the orcs are a metaphor for life's problems. Life doesn't give a shit how many fireballs you have left in you. Life doesn't care about telling a good story or if you're having fun. Life doesn't care that your mom is dying of cancer and that you put your dog down last week. You are still fired. Turn in the Dynex report and clear out your fucking shit. To be fair, the last part didn't exactly apply, but I think he got the point, and nonetheless, the party lost their wizard. Chapter 6. Game 3. I had to hand it to these dweebs. They were fucking shit up. Pretty good. A lot of teamwork happening. They killed 2 goblin kings and well on their way to securing the forbidden sword of Ashtadon. It was a glorious evening. And Claire, the party's cleric, was eye-fucking the shit out of James, the party's fighter. After James killed that second goblin king almost second-handedly, I offered him a job as a regional sales manager on the spot. If you ever have any interest in getting into industrial PVF wholesaling, I would put you in charge of 3 distribution centers day 1 without any hesitation. I shook his hand and gave him my watch. James is a solid fucking guy, and I could tell you what, Claire was feeling it too. That night, they fucked for the first time, and that kid is a closer if I've ever seen one. Great kid. Great kid. From Chapter 9, titled Game 4. Before the party left the village they had saved last game, the party's bard, Bryce, wanted to throw in his 2 cents. Could you please call me by my character's name, Lentil? Bryce asked. So Bryce, don't ever ask another man anything like that again. Also, Bryce added, Lentil is a halfling bard who is really meant for more role-playing moments. Do you think we could do less fighting this game? His goal is to return to his shire and start a beet farm. Okay, Bryce, I think we can do something with that, I confirmed. After a short zombie fight, the party returned to Lentil's beet farm. I informed Lentil that beet sales were in the shitter and that he needed a strong third quarter or the bank was going to take his farm away. Also, his wife, who insisted they put that pool in before he went on his quest, has been pretty lonely, and the neighbors say she's been taking longer and longer trips to the blacksmith. It's put up or shut up time, Lentil, I screamed. No one wants beets, but guess what? You fucking grow beets, and those pool payments are stacking up. Are you going to sit there and let that blacksmith fuck your wife, or are you going to go to parlay this shit and stay... Sorry, doctor says I got to take my blood pressure medicine. Fine. I forget to take them for a few days. I catch up. Are you going to sit there and let that blacksmith fuck your wife, or are you going to parlay this shit-stained beet farm into the biggest beet conglomerate the realm has ever seen? Buy the town, start a blacksmithing subsidiary, put that motherfucker out of business slowly so your wife can see what a fucking loser he is? Lintel hears the news about his wife and becomes upset, Bryce said. I think he might cry, he added. All right, Bryce, why don't you go ahead and roll for fucking crying then, okay? And tell you what, why don't you roll with advantage because you're a fucking coward? Here, I'll roll too. Well, natural 20, the blacksmith fucked everyone you ever cared about. Needless to say, Lintel lost the farm and the party lost their bard. Chapter 25, The Final Battle. Claire was 8 months pregnant. And James was going by Jim now. Solid choice. Jim was late to the game because he was finishing up the stainless steel index analysis I had been on his ass about all week at work. Claire, awkwardly making small talk, mentioned that they had come up with a name for their baby. She told Eric, the party's ranger, that they were going to name the baby after his character, Braden. Eric flipped the fuck out. I was saving that name for my child someday, he yelled. Impulsively, I laughed out loud at the idea of Eric ever getting laid. Ours is different, Claire said. We are spelling it B-R-A-Y-D-E-N. It was Jim's idea. We thought you'd be happy. I didn't even stick around in the room long enough to hear the rest of the conversation. I immediately went to the next room and called Jim. Got him on the phone and said, Jim, no boy should ever have a Y in their name. It is soft and implies weakness. You ever meet one of those guys named Courtney? I asked. Yeah, Jim replied. Was he worth a shit? I didn't think so. The last man who had any business having a Y in his name was Ulysses S. Grant, and unless this kid is going to wage a brutal war of attrition against a bunch of racist crybaby rednecks, then I think you can just go ahead and turn in that Dynex report and clear out your shit. I can't have this kind of judgment running my top three distribution centers. You're fucking fired, James. Thank you.
Devious work by Zach Chadworth, reminding me in the way that evil will of my producer Natalie, and the way she has systematically destroyed everything I care about. Our next author is a resident of Las Vegas, Nevada. Her first book, I Fell in Love, has gained cult status since its release in 2016. The infamous book shares her stories as the fiancé of a high-profile inmate currently behind bars. Please enjoy a true treat and welcome Lynn Clover.
Well, I guess you guys could say that I have a type. I mean, my first crush was Charlie Manson. I mean, my God, he was on all of the news and everything with those crazy dead eyes. And, you know, I mean, you could just fall right into him. Those eyes, I mean. And also, like, he never really, like, actually killed anybody. So it's not like I'm attracted to murderers or anything. But it's true. I do have a type. I do. I like the bad boys. But like the famous ones. I like famous bad boys that are like constantly on the news. I do. So, you know, naturally when Making a Murderer came on, I was like, holy shit. Like, Stephen Avery is really hot, right? So, yeah, I suppose you could say that right after that documentary came out, the first season, that my true feelings really started developing for him. And it's not just because that he's famous. It's also because he's super hot. I mean, I live in Las Vegas, and I'm around a lot of hot people, so I know what hot people look like. And Stephen Avery is one of them. So anyway, I decided right after I saw the first season of the documentary that I was going to write him a letter just to say hi. I want you guys to know that I did want to be a part of his life. I did. I didn't necessarily start out on a mission to, like, be in a relationship with him, but it, like, maybe was a goal, you know? I'm getting ahead of myself. I should start at the beginning of this journey, right? So I saw the documentary, Making a Murderer, and I just knew right away that Stephen Avery was innocent, you know? He's innocent, and it is, he is. And I just felt like he's alone in that jail cell, and I'm alone here in Las Vegas. So, you know. I was alone besides my daughter. But she doesn't really count. She's not even famous or anything. She's just really normal. She's really normal and pretty boring, actually. But anyways, you know, there's like things that a woman needs that just aren't being serviced by a daughter, you creeps. And that's really what I wanted to say, is just as I was recently divorced. My ex-husband was on the news only a couple times for armed robbery. They didn't even interview me. So that was a year wasted of my life with that marriage. Local news only. Local news only. I'm going to be famous. Yeah, so I left him because he was real boring. He was real boring, and then that's when I saw Steven. That's when I saw Steven on the Netflix, and I just knew. I thought to myself, now there's my knight in shining armor. He's so famous, like super famous. People are like tweeting about him, and he has like a whole series. So anyways, I knew from the first episode that I wanted to be, if there was a second season of that Netflix special, that I would be on it. Yeah, I would totally be on it. I was not gonna be on it. I wanted to star in it because I was gonna be his girlfriend. So that night, after I finished the documentary, sitting with my boring-ass daughter, I said, I'm going to write him a letter. And I did. I wrote him a letter, and I said, I'm just going to read you a little excerpt of the first letter that I wrote to Stephen Avery really quick. Dearest Stephen, I am so sorry for everything you're going through. I just know that you're innocent. I know you're innocent, and I hope that they make a sequel to your documentary. I think you're really sexy, like a bear, like a bear that lives in an auto salvage yard that's been rooting around in the dirt a while. I am very horny. And then the rest is like, you have to buy the book to get the sweet deets. And then I close by saying, are they making a sequel to your documentary? If so, I want to be on it. I want to be with you, and I want to be famous. Respectfully, yours. And so, like, he wrote back to me immediately, and then we got engaged. So the next few months, we wrote back back and forth, and I knew that he was, you know, in love with me. And then I was like, okay, now this is the time where I get to call the documentary makers so that they can tell all the news media that we're together. And I don't want to spoil the rest of the book for you guys, but I am on Dr. Phil. I thank you very much for your time.
Lynn Clover describing her forbidden love, much like the love I have for this program and for the authors that appear on it, that is forbidden to me, it would seem in the future, by the maniacal actions of a millennial megalomaniac named Natalie. Our next author is the foremost scholar in the fusion musical style of hip-hopera. She has studied with contemporary greats including Luciano Pavarotti, Cicely Bertoli, and Ol' Dirty Bastard. May he rest in peace. She will now read from her thesis, Your Mama So Fat, When She Sings, The Opera Is Over. This is Caroline Soprano.
What's my weakness, men? Okay, then. Chilling, chilling, minding my business. But I looked around and I couldn't believe this. I saw, I stared. My niece, my witness. The brother had it going on with something kind of wicked, wicked. I had to kick it. I'm not shy, so I asked for his digits. I don't know how you do the voodoo that you do so well. Hell makes me wanna shop. I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I had my way, 'cause every day would be Friday. You could even speed on the highway. I would play ghetto games, name my kids ghetto names like Little Mookie, Big Al, and Lorraine. Hey, you, what's that sound? Everybody, look what's going down. Oh, yes, ain't that fresh? Everybody wants to get down like that. I've got five on it. Woke up quick at about noon. Just thought that I had to be in Compton soon. Gotta get drunk before the day begins, before my mom starts bitching about my friends. About to go, damn near went blind. Young people on this block throwing up gang signs. I went in the house to get the clip with the MAC-10 on the side of my hip. I bailed outside and I pointed my weapon. And just as I thought, the fools kept stepping. I jumped in my car, hit the juice and the ride. I've got front and back and side to side. 'Cause the boys in the hood are always hard. Come talking that trash and we'll pull your card. Knowing nothing in life but to be legit. Don't quote me, boy, I ain't said shit.
Powerful, powerful work from Miss Caroline Soprano. Melancholy, somber, catchy, and yet depressing. I don't know if that is the intent of the music or the energy I brought to my listening. Either way, I feel worse than I did before. Our final author will read from his autobiographical joke book, From the High Top to the Big Seas. This is Pirate Clown Topsy Scurvy.
You're good to see y'all tonight. How are we all doing? I can't hear you. All right, let me get in my reading mode. Oh, well, that's better. This is quite a unique book I've got for you this evening. It's a joke book with little bits of autobiographical information in it. So I hope you enjoy. If you like a joke, you can use it on your kids or someone else's kids or whatever you want. What year was the pirate clown born? This is a call and response thing. Circus 1980 rum. Why did the pirate clown only have one leg? Don't know, never pegged the reason. Didn't know much about my parents. My father was a seaman and my mother was a carny. Also, she was a heavy smoker. Guess that could explain the wonky leg. Got myself a real good wood one now, though. What do you call a pirate clown's family? Shippy parents. They were always too busy clowning around. That is to say, they were out of the picture. Abandoned as an infant, I was left with my mother's former employer, a seafaring cabaret called Cirque du Soleil. I was taught to clown by a middle-aged man named Willie Blacknose. What he lacked in coming up with names, he more than made up for in skill. He claimed to have been so good that he once made Blackbeard himself laugh, though the timing of that doesn't exactly line up. What's the difference between a pirate clown and a clown pirate? Hard time. Willie Blacknose was merely a clown dressed like a pirate. I embraced the pirate lifestyle, all while dressed as a clown, albeit one with some pirate-like features. Often I would use my lunch hour to pilfer valuables from nearby ships, and more often than not, I would be tossed into the brig for my misdeeds. Turns out I had a unique set of footprints, what with the clown shoes and all. But I was never in for too long. Our ring captains practiced catch and release. What's a club? What's a pirate clown's favorite meal? Supper! Because it was the only meal provided by our circus. Fortunately, some of our animal performers would share what they caught off the docks. I guess you could say I had their seal of approval. They were seals. Why didn't the pirate clown do the trapeze? He was afraid of walking the plank. Also a bit scared of heights. The gimpy leg didn't help anything either. Where did the pirate clown lose his virginity? On the cabaret boat. Jemima was our bearded lady. Her stubble was subtle, but her theatrics were overboard. Sometimes a little too overboard. One night she fell mid-routine. I was on dinghy duty that night. Finally, she made the splash she was hoping for. Soaking wet, she struggled onto my deck. She turned me into a man, and I turned her into a big top. How did the pirate clown get his name? Jemima tipped over the dinghy and gave me scurvy. That's why they call me Topsy Scurvy. Who's a pirate clown's favorite pirate? Jolly Roger. Surprised you didn't get that one. Man goes to the doctor, says he's depressed, can't handle the sea life anymore. Hopping from port to port is catching up with him. He's sick and tired of being sick and tired. Doctor says, I've got the cure. Go see Cirque du Soleil tonight. They've got this pirate clown named Topsy Scurvy. He'll turn that frown upside down. The man bursts into tears. But doctor, I am Topsy Scurvy. Doctor says, well, and this is a bad time to tell you that you've got cancer. And some vitamin C will help with the scurvy. Eat an orange. Why was the pirate clown's costume so bland? He bought it on sale. The clown pirates aboard our vessel wore more extravagant garb, but I couldn't afford anything too colorful. Worked out for me, though. Black was to die for. Or colorful. Die for. It suited the pirate clown lifestyle, laughing by day and looting by night. What's a pirate clown's least favorite thing to do? Wave goodbye. As I had been pillaging the coast, cancer had been pillaging my body. Worst of all, there was nothing they could do. It was stage four. Mm-mm. Where does a pirate clown make his money after he leaves the circus? Children's birthday parties. Also, I invested quite a bit of money in Disney. Where do you think they got the idea for Jack Sparrow? I'd be angry, what with them stealing my idea and all, but what kind of pirate would I be if I got pissed about a little pilfering? Well, I'd say that at that point I'd be a clown pirate instead of a pirate clown. What's a pirate clown's favorite letter? Dear Topsy Scurvy, your cancer is in remission. Your bill comes to $2. That's a buccaneer. Why was the tree mad at the pirate clown? He would always disembark.
It's a strange phenomenon where my mind recognizes the terrific humor put forth by Topsy Scurvy, and yet my body is unwilling, unable to muster a laugh or any other signs of outward joy. That should not stop you from enjoying the work, though, loyal listener. We have come to the end of our program. We've come to the end. I'd like to thank the White Rabbit Cabaret in Indianapolis, Indiana, for hosting our show on the first Tuesday of every month. If you'd like to see us live and you cannot make it to Indianapolis, please follow us on social media while it lasts. You can find us on Instagram at FakeAuthorsIndie, that is at FakeAuthorsIndy, or you can find us on Facebook at FakeAuthors. If you live in the greater Detroit area, you can see us later in the month of May, where on the 17th we will be performing at the Independent Comedy Club in Hamtramck, Michigan, and the following night, the 18th, we return to Sellerman's in Hazel Park. We would love to see you there. I would like to thank Eric Salazar for providing our theme music entitled Soul Search. And most of all, loyal listeners, I would like to thank you for spending an evening with the authors. I'm Dana Glass, and that's the only thing I know for sure at this time.